From Number 5 Chambers, I'm Richard Kimblin, and this is the Planning Podcast. This episode of the Planning Podcast returns to our Top Tips team, who've been looking back and looking forward for you. You know them by now. Oliver Lawrence, good afternoon, Oliver.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Good to be with you, and good afternoon, Howard Leithhead. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm very well, thank you, Richard.
Good to see you. And Leanne Buckley-Thompson, good afternoon, and how are you post our planning reform webinar yesterday?
Richard, I am refreshed. I'm raring to go.
I believe you. Now, I am refreshed and intent upon becoming still further refreshed, and not least because it's my birthday. But before we get to birthday celebrations, can we touch upon some of the events of the year that you've been looking at via some of our podcasts? Let's go to Oliver first. Oliver, which have you been looking at?
Thanks, Richard. I've been looking at the podcast that you did with Christian Hawley in April this year, called COVID Consequences, Little Ships, in which you and Christian discussed the importance of small sites in the economic recovery after all this is over.
And shall we just have a listen to an excerpt from that to see where we were in March of this year? Let's think 2008, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, those previously obscure US lenders that went under, the financial crash that followed and the liquidity crisis, a recession and further downturn 2011-2012. Does any of that history help us or not?
Well, it does to a degree. Because at first blush, of course, the effects are the same, aren't they? What we saw after the financial crash was building sites being shuttered, sites not being viable for a very long time, developers being cautious. What we see now, building sites being shuttered, dire economic warnings, albeit some hope or optimism, and I don't know which of the two it is at this stage, as to the shape of the recovery. The difference then, of course, was that the impact was financial in nature. Financial capital is the lifeblood of the development industry. Money prior to that had been expensive. All of those economic levers were pulled after the financial crash, low interest rates, supporting the banks, in order to make sure that the economy didn't seize up and fail. We've got a similar situation here, but a different problem. The issue isn't so much lending and finance. The issue is, how do we get the economy back and how do we get the confidence back when people are ultimately slowly going to emerge from this lockdown? It's not going to be a 24-hour transition back to what was normal. There's this new normal that's talked about, and it's how we manage our way through that.
Okay, so that's the virus, but here we've got something else which is obscure. We had this virus in a pangolin in a market in Wuhan, which was previously unknown to us, and now leaders speak of a war on the virus, and the Queen invokes Dame Vera Lynn. World War II references are the go-to references in this battle. But turning from the virus and back to the economy, think Dunkirk, think Little Ships, small but vital contributions to efforts in the national interest. Taking a big leap there to planning, why should little sites help us?
Little sites help us because in a situation like this, every little helps. But that's not just the end of it. Small sites became a particular focus of government policy post-crash, indeed significantly post-crash, 2014. The realisation that historically small to medium enterprise-sized house builders using small to medium-sized sites had historically delivered large amounts of housing numbers. So in 1988, some 40% of housing completions. By 2019, that was down to 12%. The impact of the financial crash had been to halve the numbers of small builders that were out there. And you know, small sites can be ignored. They don't deliver 1,000 homes or 3,000 homes. They deliver maybe 5 or maybe 15. But the point is, they all add up. And actually, it's small sites which can be delivered quickly. And they deliver locally. They deliver benefits locally. They deliver jobs locally. They have spin-off benefits, which are local in terms of council tax receipts, input into the local economy, fulfilling job vacancies in the locality. It's critical that these small sites come forward in the future, and in my view, at an accelerated rate.
And so, Oliver, any reflections on where we are now compared to where we were in March?
Well, around the time that you did that podcast, Richard, we didn't know that planning reform was going to happen, although it was always a powerful way to restore the economy. Now, Christian there has highlighted some key points. First, he's pointed out that small housing sites are very important to an economic recovery because they deliver houses quickly. And second, he's pointed out that relatively speaking, they are delivering far fewer houses than they were decades ago. Well, why is this? It's important to work out why in order to arrive at an answer as to what the government can do about it. Well, first, small sites, they have less prospective profit to play with. And so viability negotiations on small sites are massively extending the determination timeframe. House builders and councils, they often disagree on benchmark land values and other viability parameters. And these protracted viability negotiations inevitably extend determination periods. That's the first point. The second point is that house builders on small sites are often required to accept non-viable affording housing levels in order to secure permission. So in short, we're asking small sites to do a bit too much, and you know, judging them on the same basis as large sites when they don't have as much space to accommodate multiple tenures, it inhibits delivery and it creates lengthy disputes. And of course, the more complex the affordable housing requirements, the longer planning takes. The permissions with mixed tenure affordable housing on site, they take longer to be determined, of course. So in a nutshell, the government needs to not only reduce affordable housing obligations for small sites, but to simplify them as well.
Fantastic. Well, it's been so helpful to have that potted history, not least because we're able to see now just the really, really substantial importance which is now attached to build, build, build. And it is the story which evolved during the course of the summer with the Prime Minister's announcement on his excursion to Dudley. But let's turn from that, Oliver, if we may, now to a slightly different topic with Howard. Howard, what have you been listening to?
Thank you, Richard. A highlight for me was your interview with Dame Bridget Rosewell in September. This was around the time that your book on planning appeals was published. I should say that it's available from all good bookshops and would make an excellent Christmas present for anyone interested in planning appeals. It was interesting to hear what Dame Bridget thought were the key benefits of the reforms instituted after her review into planning appeals. She highlighted the advantage in appointing inspectors early and holding case management hearings at an early stage to work out the format in which evidence should be given. I think we can hear a few minutes of that again.
Let's do that. Let's hear a little of that.
One is the early appointment of an inspector who looks at it, decides what sort of representations and what the key issues are that need to be examined, and which of them need a proper cross-examination, and the requirement to have a pre-inquiry call within 6 weeks of the appeal being lodged, at which all the interested parties can get together and make some, you know, mutual decisions about where, when, how, and what is going to be examined in what way, whether by written reps or whether by round tables or indeed by full cross-examination.
Well, I agree with you. That is the point of the review, which has had by far the biggest impact. The ability to get everybody together, as you say, in front of somebody who is either senior or is going to be the inspector for the appeal event, has made a huge difference.
Yeah, and it should make sure that you're looking at the right things. Now, it does rely enormously on how inspectors are being trained and that they are both picking up the right issues for cross-examination, but equally managing the things which don't need to go to cross-examination in the right way. And I have had some people push back and say, some things have gone to written reps, which should not have done and should have benefited from full cross-examination. I have to say, it's usually barristers who tell me this. So who knows whether they're actually right or not. But I can see there might be some potential in that area. But on the whole, I think that it might need a bit of time to bed in properly. But it's the timetables work.
They do. And I don't know of anybody who would say that having the appropriate mix of modes is wrong. But I think that you're right. People are feeling their way through it. And I suspect that so far as the calling of evidence and cross-examination are concerned, that there is a difference of understanding as to what their roles might be. My experience is that inspectors very much think that it's necessary when there is testing required. But there's also, I think, an important aspect, which is the ability to hear what the answer is to your case. So the ability to put your case to the other side and find out whether or not there really is an answer to it. And also to persuade through the calling of evidence, to have the person who is expert to, you know, bring them to the table and say, look, this person says this, show them they're wrong. So it's that sort of balance of features, which is the beauty of that part of the inquiry procedure. But there are other things, particularly parts of five-year land supply and some other matters, legal submissions, that they're not apt for the calling of evidence. And to have a mix of modes is really a benefit in that respect. Well, that's my view anyway.
Well, I think also making sure that expert witness is you don't have to have a witness for everything, and you concentrate the witness input and the expert input on the things which are really going to make a difference. One change that I didn't make that I wanted to, and they are working on guidance, I wanted to change the name of the statement of common ground.
Okay.
To the statement of uncommon ground. In other words, what...
You wanted to know the disputes.
Exactly.
And so, Howard, what do you say about what Dame Bridget had to say on those two points?
I think she's absolutely right, Richard. For those of us who are used to doing court cases as well as planning appeals, the idea of a case management hearing at an early stage is nothing new. It's really useful to be able, in planning inquiries now, to get everyone together to address the key issues and to work out the best way of dealing with them. We've all sat through cross-examinations and maybe even participated in some that just didn't need to be done. Equally, there's real value in being able to put issues directly to a witness in particular situations. If it's done right, it can really assist an inspector in understanding why the witnesses hold different views and ultimately in deciding who is right. Of course, all this is possible now following the amendments introduced into the Town and Country Planning Act by the Business and Property Act 2020, which we discussed in another podcast in July.
Well, we did, didn't we? And there is, in fact, a rather helpful paper on that topic, which I think that we ought to flag up. I think that's on the website. And we'll put the link with this podcast. Shall we do that, Howard?
That sounds like a very good idea.
Excellent. Well, there we go, Howard. That was Bridget Rosewell, OBE. Thank you very much indeed. Let's turn now to Leanne, because Leanne, I think that you've been keeping your eye out for top tips. Is there a top tip this week?
Richard, yes, I believe there is. And it's an interesting case, I think. It's the case of R on the application of Elizabeth Wingfield and Canterbury City Council. Now, Richard, I decided just after midnight on Monday to cover this case because, of course, who does not spend their time into the wee hours looking at different planning cases? I will take any silence from our listeners, not as pity, but as quiet solidarity with me on that. And I can't be in the minority because, of course, our newest member to the planning team at number five, Sinead Davies, covered this case later that day. And I absolutely recommend reading her really helpful summary of that case on our website now. A little plug from me. But in short, that case concerns the application of Civil Procedure Rule 52.30. And everyone will know, of course, that that concerns the reopening of the final determination of appeals. If you don't know, don't worry, because I'm going to tell you that there are three steps, three criteria that need to be satisfied in order for the court to do that. And it is only the Court of Appeal or High Court, not the County Court. Those three things are that it's necessary to do so in order to avoid real injustice. Secondly, that the circumstances are exceptional and make it appropriate. And then finally, that there is no alternative effective remedy. And I should just point out that appeal here includes applications for permission to appeal as well. Even where permission wasn't required at the first instance, you still need permission to reopen. So with that background, what are the facts of this case? Well, it concerned two applications to reopen final appeals regarding decisions of Canterbury City Council to grant permission for separate but adjacent sites, those sites being the Hoplands and the Chislett. And Ms Wingfield was a local resident who'd initially sought judicial review of the decisions to grant permission for those schemes. The basis of those JRs was alleged deficiencies in the approach taken, in particular to EIA and habitats assessments, Richard. She was refused permission twice, so she sought to use the provisions at 52.30 to reopen the orders. And the merits of her case have been considered by the court on five separate occasions, I have to say, with the Chislett site, and four for the Hopland site by the time we got here. So did she win? No, she didn't. The court considered that her case was inarguable. She failed to meet any of the criteria. And you might be thinking, well, how is this useful then? Why am I bothering to tell you about this case? Well, I'll tell you why. Three points. The Court of Appeal considered the purpose and parameters of 52.30 and first found that finality in litigation is, as a general rule, of high public importance. I don't think that's a surprise. But helpfully, they said, particularly in planning cases, is that so? There's a need for a speedy determination, and there are many people other than those directly connected that would be affected by the outcome in planning cases. I think we'd all agree with that. Second, that it would subvert the arrangements of the planning court and broader judicial review if unsuccessful litigants could continually revive the same arguments without limit. And I would just emphasise here that that's really unsurprising given the 6-week time limit for JR. It would be shocking, wouldn't it, if one could continue to reopen decisions in those circumstances. And then finally, the court warned that litigants seeking to challenge a decision and their representative should adopt a sensible, responsible approach and should refrain from abusive proceedings. So I think that's a really helpful case, actually, in relation not only to highlighting the fact that that provision even exists for those that aren't aware of it, but also really the remit within which it should be used.
It is, absolutely. And thank you for framing that in those three highly practical points. And one can well see that if your proposal is plagued by litigation, that there is a means there by which that plague may continue over a continued, quite a considerable period of time. And the fact that such an appeal can be reopened is really important to know about when advising. And so thank you very much indeed. But I don't think I should let you go. I think that I should ask you, what were you up to yesterday?
Well, Richard, we had our autumn webinar yesterday, which I would say this, but I think it was a massive success. And in particular, I was involved in a panel discussing changes that are due to come about in relation to the white paper and what really people should be doing, and in particular local authorities in relation to local plans, but also applicants in terms of whether or not they should be hanging back on making applications. So Richard, those that joined us will recall that it was myself, it was Sinead, and also JCB who dealt with that particular panel discussion. Sinead updated us in terms of how much legislative change we might expect from the reforms and gave some really helpful insight in respect of a number of key areas there. I dealt with whether or not it would be sensible for local authorities to stop working on local plans, and unsurprisingly, I said no, and gave a number of reasons why that should be the case. And then James Corbett-Bircher dealt with whether or not people should hang back on applications. And again, it was a resounding no from everyone. But Richard, it might be helpful actually to cut into an excerpt from that panel discussion from James, where he gave a really helpful summary of the discussions that we had yesterday.
Well, let's do that.
So, Richard, to take each of those three headings, I think our observations are that the promise of legislation has an illusory, a spectral quality. And in fact, we will be working with very much the same system for the next 12 months at least. Secondly, therefore, any local planning authority that has stopped work on its forthcoming local plan will find that that proves to be itself an illusory step in which they have essentially taken the wrong messaging from government, indeed certainly messaging which is not expressed on the terms of the white paper. And therefore, thirdly, in that context, we are now in a position where it makes sense to progress new applications and appeals. Think of this to look at contemporary parallels. Think of this as closer to the years immediately following the MPPF, MPPF 1, 2012 through to 2014, a period, of course, in which there was, for the most part, quite stable government within the UK in advance of the coming general election. And therefore, this is a good time, it seems to me, for the Secretary of State on contentious appeals and inspectors taking that message from the Secretary of State to grant permissions and get Britain building again, ahead of the greater complexities which may come at the general election level from 2023, latter 2023, 2024 onwards. So if you want to look at where we're going, look at the lessons from the recent past, obviously with some qualification for the inevitable black swans and uncertainties thrown up by Brexit.
I want just to turn to some other features of this year and next year, because we had from Nina Pindham a wonderful exposition of where we are heading in terms of net zero aspirations in a variety of contexts. And I think it's worth us hearing that, because we have much happening on the international stage in this regard during the course of this weekend, given the UK's involvement in trying to get the world to address climate change, while, of course, there is also much interest in fish and state aid, looking after the planet is also one of the topics for the weekend. So let's hear Nina.
Let's start off by understanding what net zero is. My recollection of it is that we spent some years trying to work out whether we were going to leave the European Union or not. And just towards the dying days of the last Parliament, a lot happened in respect of this major policy area. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. And you mentioned the long drawn out Brexit process. And for those of us, I don't want to invite people to remember those days, but we certainly we're not impressed by the speed with which Parliament was acting in terms of Brexit. So we were all very happily surprised by the speed with which we obtained a legislative duty to achieve net zero. So for those of us who, for those who don't remember, the Committee on Climate Change issued their net zero technical report in May. And the government consulted on its response to potentially legislating for a net zero target in June. And by the 27th of June last year, we had a new Section 1 duty under the Climate Change Act for the government to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050.
Now, Nina, this is the 2008 Act, isn't it? So are you talking about an amendment?
That's it. So the initial target for 2050 was to reach a net UK carbon account of only 80% of emissions assessed against the 1990 baseline. So we can see there is a huge uplift in ambition between the previous target and the one we are now all working towards.
Now, that's a legal obligation. We're going to hear later about still more ambitious targets adopted by some local authorities and indeed perhaps by some major undertakings such as, for example, Microsoft. Are they legal obligations?
No, well, that's what's so interesting. Normally, when you have a legal obligation, that's what people work towards. But what's so fascinating about the net zero work that's taking place is that we're seeing a hugely more ambitious agenda being pursued by local government, as we will hear, and indeed companies, as you mentioned, such as Microsoft, which is pledged to offset every single greenhouse gas emission that they've been directly responsible for ever since the company was founded. So there's a great range of ambition, but quite a lot of it is significantly more ambitious than even the government's own extremely ambitious goals. So hugely encouraging work being undertaken out there, which we will hear about shortly.
Indeed.
Well, and thank you very much to Nina for that. We will pick up net zero during the course of next year and see where we have got to in terms of those very important attempts to reach a global consensus. That was the Planning Podcast from Number 5 Chambers. If you like it, let us know. Change will be with us from all directions during the course of next year. We will be monitoring, we'll be commentating, and we will be trying to bring to you in as succinct a way as possible the key top tips of a practical nature which will help you during the course of 2021. But for now, my thanks are extended to Oliver, to Howard and Leanne for their top tips and for being with us this afternoon. Thank you to you all. Good afternoon. Stay safe.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. And thank you to you as well for being an excellent host as always.
Agreed.
Take care. Take care, all.